Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1978, noted economist Friedrich Hayek and the founder of Free to Choose Network, Bob Chittister, continue to discuss American thought and culture and the ramifications of constant change in American economic and social policies. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I can't resist to talk some more about the snuff. You said you have the shop in London.
Yes, it's a very special snuff, a very old one, Fribourg Traer, which, like an English shop, still uses the same label which he used in the 18th century. And I have now discovered and tried that he produced 36 different snuffs. And the one I decided was much the best has a beautiful name of Dr. James Robinson's Judge's Mixture.
That sounds good.
And it is very good.
Why do you use snuff?
Well, I was stopped from smoking by the doctor some 5 years ago and was miserable for a long time. I was a heavy pipe smoker. And then by chance, I found in my own drawer of my desk an old snuff box, which I had used years ago at the British Museum when I was working long hours in the museum. And finally, my neighbor just joked that, how silly to go out every hour for a cigarette. You know, I have snuff, and that relieves me completely of the longing. So I got snuff for the same purpose, which worked, but I didn't acquire the habit then. I put it aside, and I found it. And as I was miserable, not being allowed to smoke, I found that old snuff box in my drawer, and took some snuff, and found the longing for a cigarette at once stopped. So I started taking it up, and I become completely hooked. It's as much a habit-forming thing, and you get all the nicotine you want. But the worst thing of smoking, of course, is the tar that you don't get. So I get my pleasure without a little danger.
Do you have a collection of snuff boxes?
A small collection, yes. Mm-hmm. Beginning to.
They to acquire. It's like wine and cheeses and things like that.
It's only something like 2 or 3 years that it has become really a habit.
Do you? How do you feel about the question of cigarette smoking? You know, in the United States, there's a lot of pressure to people to quit.
Well, it's probably sensible, so long as they don't legislate about it. I think there's even a case for preventing it in public places where it annoys other people. But even that doesn't require legislation. I think restaurants should have their choice of customers. Mm-hmm. But I am convinced that cigarettes are harmful. Although my own brother, the late anatomist, was the one who argued most convincingly that it was not cigarettes, but the effusion of cars and so on, which were the main cause of lung cancer. Well, I'm afraid he died of heart disease, I think largely induced by smoking.
Well, one pays the piper at some point. Ascribe to the theory, Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens said, well, he had to have a certain amount of moderately sinful behavior so he would have something to throw overboard as he got older and needed redemption. He said he wouldn't give up smoking because cigars because he felt he needed that at some point in the future, that he would have something to give up.
Well, I don't intend to give this.
You don't intend to give it up. Very good. There's an aspect of any individual that's involved in creative work that fascinates me. And when I say creative work, I don't limit it to intellectual. People who work with their hands, even a farmer. A farmer to me is involved in very creative work. And that is that there is an excitement about what one does. A feeling. It's one of those intangibles. It's like saying, well, what is love, or how do you describe the sense of love? But I personally feel it. I'm excited about being involved in things. You must have had, you
yes.
must...
I get more excited by exposition than by quiet writing, by oral exposition. I can't eat after they've given a lecture. Even my ordinary university lectures, I used at Cambridge lecture 12 to 1. We had to postpone lunch to 2. I couldn't possibly eat as I came back from a lecture. Just too much excited from giving a lecture. Quiet work, of course, there is an excitement of a different sort, an elation, but it's purely pleasant and doesn't have any lasting effect like the effort of explaining it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. That is an excitement of a different nature. And lecturing, of course, is in general a very peculiar experience. I will tell you a story, although it may lead off the point. My second visit to the United States in 1945 was occasioned by the publication of The Road to Serfdom. I was asked to come over to give a 5 series of lectures at 5 universities. I imagined very sedate academic lectures, which I had written out very carefully. Then I came, it was still war, in slow convoy. And while I was on the high seas, the condensation of the Reader's Digest in the the condensation of The Road to Serfdom in the Reader's Digest appeared. So when I arrived, I was told the program is off. The University of Chicago Press had handed over the arrangement to the National Concerts and Artists Organization. I was to go in a public lecture tour all around the country. I said, my God, I've never done this. I can't possibly do it. I have no experience in public. Oh, it can't be helped now. Well, when do we start? Oh, you are late. We have already arranged for tomorrow, Sunday morning, a meeting at Town House, New York. It first didn't make any impression upon me. I rather imagined a little group of old ladies like the Hokanson women in the New Yorker. And only next morning, when I was picked up at my hotel, taken to Town House, I asked, what sort of audience do we expect? The hall held 3,000, but there's an overflow meeting. My God, and I haven't an idea what I'm going to say. Oh, how have you announced it? Oh, we have called it the rule of law in international affairs. My God, I've never thought about that problem in my life. So I knew as I sat down on that platform, with all the paraphernalia I didn't know at that time, it was still dictating machines below and so on, I knew if I didn't get tremendously excited, it would break down. The last thing I remember is that I asked the chairman, 3/4 of an hour will be enough. Oh no, it must be exactly an hour. I got up with these words in my ear without the slightest idea of what I was going to say. But it began with a tone of profound conviction, not knowing how I would end the sentence. And it turned out that the American public is an exceedingly grateful and easy public. You can see from their faces whether they're interested or not. And I got through this hour swimmingly without having any experience. And if I'd been told beforehand, I would say, I can't possibly do it. And I went through the United States for 5 weeks doing that stunt every day, more or less, and came back as what I thought was an experienced public lecturer, to be bitterly disappointed as I came back to England. Soon after I came back, I was asked to give a lecture to some public group at Manchester, and I tried to do my American stunt with the stolid North English citizen not moving a muscle in their face. I very nearly broke down because I could not be guided by their expression. It's a sort of lecturing which you can do to an American audience, but not to a British audience.
It was a
very instructive experience.
Yes, I can understand. I can understand it from the one side, having done public speaking to American audience, and knowing even there that there is clearly much more responsiveness than what I understand is true of European audiences. But even there's a range, and that many times you will have an audience that is very, very flat.
Oh, and it happens, yes, they don't help. Well, after all, you see, in the further, the New York audience apparently was a particularly favorable one, which helped me. I didn't know in the end what I had said, but evidently it was a very successful lecture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure you've also had the experience of there you're talking about feedback, essentially, the feeling on the part of the audience that they like what you're saying, the encouragement, the movement ahead. You do that. You would get that out of students also.
No, one doesn't get it.
Wouldn't?
And I think I ought to have added that what I did in America is a very corrupting experience.
Mm-hmm.
You become an actor, and I didn't know I had it in me, but given the opportunity to play with an audience, I began enjoying.
It's very tempting, yes. It becomes a show more than a communication. It's entertainment.
Yeah.
Coming back to the question on it, why do you work? Why do you work?
At this time, it's everything I enjoy. See, I've lost all the other hobbies. I haven't many. It was essentially mountain climbing and skiing. Now my heart will no longer play, so I had to give that up completely. I did a certain amount of photography, which was the other hobby I had. But the professionals have become so much better than anyone can hope to be that I no longer enjoy it. I can't equal these people. So I've given that up, except as when I travel. Take snaps. So I no longer have any hobbies, and there's no difference between hobby and work, particularly since I am retired. I've no longer any subject where I have to keep up. That can be a chore. I mean, if you have to give the same lecture year after year and have to inform the students about what has happened, you have to read all sorts of stuff you don't care in the least about. But now, in my retired state, the work is my pleasure.
Do you think hobbies and work are the same?
Unfortunately, not normally, but it can be. I mean, that's the most fortunate state you can be in. If what you feel is also useful to the other people is what you enjoy most, is an ideal position.
Mm-hmm. In terms of achievement, now, obviously, you can look at hobbies and work, as you said, that others benefit from it. It becomes work, I guess, is maybe one of the ways.
See, in my case, there was one particular thing. You see, I write in a language which is not my native language. And so as an adult, I went through the pleasure of learning to master a new language. And while my spoken English is not faultless, I pride myself if I have time, I can write as good English as anyone. And to learn this and to see, even in your middle age, constantly make progress in learning what is an art, was a very enjoyable experience.
Achievement again. Is that a key?
Yes. Achievement, some extent of something unforeseen arising out of your work. The pleasure I can get out of what may be childish, a good formulation. We'll give you an illustration. The next article I'm going to write, as soon as I'm rid of other things, is going to be called Mill's Muddle and the Muddle of the Middle. I think that's a beautiful title.
It's delightful.
I tremendously enjoy it.
And that's a source of enjoyment.
Yes.
Yeah. The reason I'm interested in this is it seems to me that individuals, in coming at the questions of value, questions of society, that the question of enjoyment has to be in there.
Oh, yes.
And it seems it is so often corrupting. Why is it corrupting?
I Because our instincts, which of course determines enjoyment, are not fully adapted to our present civilization. That's a point which I was touching before, that let me put it in a much more general way. The ultimate what helps us to maintain civilization is no longer satisfying aiming at maximum pleasure. Our built-in instincts, that is, pleasure which guides us, are the instincts which were conducive to the maintenance of the little roving band of 30 or 50 people. And the ultimate aim of evolution is not pleasure, but pleasure is what tells us at a particular phase what we ought to do. But that pleasure has been adapted to a quite different society which we now live in. So pleasure is no longer an adequate guide to doing what life in our present society wants. That is that conflict between the discipline of rules and the innate pleasures, which recently has been occupying so much in my work.
That suggests that we're outgrowing the almost the usefulness of our native instincts.
Yes, yes. And it does raise the question whether the too rapid civilization of growth of civilization can be sustained, and whether there may not be a revolt of our instincts against too much imposed restraints, which may destroy civilization and may be very counterproductive. But that man is capable of destroying the civilization which is built up by instincts, by rules which he feels to be restraints, is entirely a possibility.
Yes, that's a kind of a terrifying thought.
Oh, yes.
It suggests that there's no way out.
Well, there is no way out so long as it's not only instincts, but there's a very strong intellectual movement which supports this release of instincts. And I think if we can refute this intellectual movement, see, put it in most general form, I have to revert to this. Two things happened in the last 100 years. On the one hand, an always steadily increasing part of the population did no longer learn in daily life the rules of the market on which our civilization is based, because he grew up in organizations rather than as participating in the market. They no longer were taught these rules. At the same time, the intellectuals began to tell them these rules are nonsense anyhow. So they are irrational. Don't believe in that nonsense. And was the combination of these two effects. On the one hand, people no longer learning the old rules. On the other hand, the sort of Cartesian rationalism, which told them don't accept anything which you do not understand, collaborated. And this produced the present situation, where there is already a lack of the supporting moral beliefs which is required to maintain our civilization. And I have some, I must admit, slight hope that if we can refute the intellectual influence, people may again be prepared to recognize that the traditional rules, after all, had some value. Well, at present, the official belief is, it's mere cultural, which means really an absurdity.
Yes,
that view comes from the intellectuals. That doesn't come from the other development.
And it comes also from some elements of the science community, technologist point of view.
Oh, very much so. To the extent to which science is rationalistic in that specific sense of the Cartesian tradition, which again comes to the formula, don't believe anything which you cannot prove. And our ethics belong to the category that which you can't prove.
Don't you feel, though, that the average individual finds that to be difficult? I, as a person, have a sense of joy, of excitement, and it is not based on a rational perception. And I am fairly willing to accept it as such. And isn't there a way we can somehow or other sublimate what's happening in you know, the changes of society? As you said, your native ability doesn't work anymore. But yet there ought to be some way to relate those instincts to a changing society.
I hope it can be done. You see that these instincts, of course, are source of most of our pleasure, you see, in the whole field of art. There it's quite clear. But how you can evoke the same sort of feeling by what comes essentially to those rules of conduct which are required to maintain a civilized society, I don't know.
Those people who work for themselves, who are not guided by a master, must they not, as a class, have that as a motivation? Isn't that a got? Doesn't to be an element?
No doubt, they have some such motivation, but it's not a thing you can create. At least, perhaps it can spread by imitation, by example. But I wouldn't know any way in which you can systematically teach it.
I would assume that statistically, it can be shown that a lot of people who work for themselves don't do so for purely economic gain, because it could be shown that they could do better in a different situation.
Surely. You know, I am in the habit of maintaining that, so far as literary production is concerned, there's no justification for copyright, because no great piece of writing has been done for money. It's not strictly true, Trollope has done it. But that's the only outstanding example I know. And I don't think our literature would be much poorer if it were not a way of making a living.
No, that's true. I think many people are motivated to write for other than monetary reasons.
Surely.
I think Dickens was also, in certain circumstances, writing in exchange for dollars and
Yes, so I think he did have to write, and perhaps in this case the compulsion was a good thing. But there are very few instances when, if you ask the question, which great works of literature would we not have if there hadn't been for the incentive of earning an income from it, the number is very small indeed.
Let's go back. You said that today you work because you get enjoyment out of it. And if we go back 50 years in Hayek's existence, and if I were to take one thing away from you that would have made it, that would have changed your attitude toward what you were doing so that you no longer would have cared to proceed with, what would that one thing be that I could take, that if I took it away, your desire to proceed would be eliminated?
Well, I suppose the one thing which might have changed my own development would have been if there didn't exist that esteem for intellectual work, which in an academic academic environment, okay. See, my determination to become a scholar was certainly affected by the unsatisfied ambition of my father to become a university professor. It wasn't completely unsatisfied. He was, by profession, a doctor. He became a botanist. His main interest became botany. He became ultimately what's called an extraordinary professor at the university. At the end of his life, it was his only occupation. but to the greater part of my childhood, the hope for a professorship was a dominating feature. I mean, behind the scene was much talked about, but I was very much aware that in my father, the great ambition of his life, that time unsatisfied, was to be a university professor. So I grew up with the idea that there was nothing higher in life than becoming a university professor. Without any clear conception of which the subject was I wanted to do, it just seemed to me this was the worthwhile occupation for your life. And I went to a very long change of interest. I grew up as a biologist in my this background. I think it was a purely an accident that I didn't stick to it, as my father gave me too early. I was not, I should first say, satisfied with sort of taxonomic work in botany or zoology. I was looking for something theoretical. At a relatively early stage, when I was 13 or 14, my father gave me a treatise on what we now call genetics. It was then called theory of evolution, which was already still a bit too difficult for me. It was too early for me to follow a sustained theoretical argument. I think if you'd given me the book a year later, I would have stuck to biology. In fact, my interest started wandering, and from biology to general questions of evolution, like paleontology, was a state I got more and more interested in men rather than in general nature. At one stage, I even thought of becoming a psychiatrist. And then it was the experience of the war. I was on active service in World War I. I still fought for a year in Italy. And the watching of the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire turned my interest to politics and political problems. So it was just as the war ended and I came back that I decided, well, I didn't even decide to do economics. I was hesitating between economics and psychology. And although my study was confined to 3 years at veterans' privileges, and I did a first-class law degree, I divided my time essentially between economics and psychology. And it was for essentially practical reasons that I decided on economics rather than psychology, really, to do. Psychology was very badly represented at the university. There was no practical possibility of using it outside a university career at the time, while economics offered a prospect. And finally, I got definitely hooked by economics by becoming acquainted with a particular tradition, the textbook of Karl Menger, which was wholly satisfactory to me, where I could step into an existing tradition while my psychological ideas did not fit into any established tradition. It would not have given me an easy access to an academic career. And so I became an economist, although the psychological ideas continued to occupy me, in fact, still helped me in methodological approach to the social sciences. And I finally wrote out the ideas I'd formed as a student 30 years later, or nearly 30 years later, in that book, The Sense of Reorder. And I still have a great interest in certain aspects of psychology, although not what is predominantly taught on that name, which I have not the greatest respect.
What's your reaction at this point about having achieved what your father desired, i.e. that he desired to be a professor as an ultimate and a measure of achievement? Is there a secret wish somewhere in Professor Hayek that knowing what you now know, you might have attempted to strive to achieve some other objective?
I think my choice was right. I'm satisfied with the choice. There was a period when the position of a professor gratified me, and I think it's appropriate to old age that I'm now relieved of any formal duties, but have been through that experience. In fact, up to a point, I still enjoy teaching. I have a marvelous arrangement. I mean, the German universities are, in that respect, ideal. You are just relieved of duties, but you retain your rights. So I can still teach. I do it in the easy manner of joining in with one of my active colleagues who takes the responsibility, and I sit in the seminar, which is the absolutely ideal position my age.
You're making a hobby out of your of your vocation in that sense. It's interesting. Is it important in the sense of joy that one achieves that there is external recognition of excellence?
Yes. Although I don't think I was ever guided in the choice of the subjects I worked on by the aim at recognition. But when it comes, it's very pleasant. But I would not have regretted having spent my life on something which I still thought was important but had not found recognition. Might have found it an inconvenience if it didn't bring an adequate income. But it would not have been a major grief to me if I was convinced something would ultimately be recognized as important, because perhaps after my death and in my lifetime, I found no little recognition. In fact, recognition in that sense, except in a very narrow group of colleagues, is a new experience to me. I mean, at this one period of popularity after the publication of The Road to Serfdom. But so far as public recollection is concerned, as we mentioned before, the period between 50 and 70 was a period when I would almost say had become relatively unknown. I've always regretted the remark I made to my wife in 1950, which I think was true at the time, but ceased soon to be true, that when Keynes died, I was probably the best-known economist. And at that time, as a result of the controversy between us, we were the two leading economists. But when Keynes died, he became a saint, and I was forgotten. As a curious development. And between 50 and 70, I was known to a few specialists, but not to the public at large.
In periods of time like that, you need a guidepost against which to judge your achievements. I mean, we all do this. We have measuring tools.
Well, I was sufficiently settled by the age of 50 or the early 50s. You might even say your habits, your immediate aims are very much settled. I knew. I never had any ambition of public activity. In fact, at a very early stage, I came to the conclusion that for an economist, it was not a good thing to be involved in government. Long before I confirmed it my own experience, I used to say that in the 20s, England and Austria produced good economists because they were not involved in policy matters, and Germany and America produced bad economists because we were all tied up in politics. I have, by my migrations, avoided getting tied up in politics. I left Austria almost immediately. It was by accident, after I'd been called to sit in on the first governmental committee. I left England after 20 years, and it takes much longer there, just after the colonial office had begun to use me for public matters. I was never long enough in the United States to be used for public affairs. And, of course, in Germany, when I arrived as an old man, I think it was not alone a practical problem. So I'm almost unique among economists of some reputation of practically never having been tied up in government work. And I think it has been done me a lot of good. Government work corrupts. I have observed in some of my best friends who, as a result of the war, got tied up in government work. And they've ever since been statesmen rather than scholars.
One problem I understand, and I'm very sympathetic to that perspective. How does one translate, then, from the theoretical to the practical and political? Who is the intermediary? Is there a class of individual, then, that must lie between the intellectual and the politician? How do you bridge the gap?
Well, the economists whom we train to not become academics also do their job. So all we are training, unfortunately, far too many, and certainly many more than ought to go into academic life. And I don't mind even people of first-class quality going into politics. All I'm saying is they no longer have the right approach to the purely abstract theoretical work. They are beginning to think about what is politically possible. While I have made it a principle never to ask that question, my aim is to make politically possible what in the present state of opinion is not politically possible.
A parallel I see to what you're saying is in the case of Dr. Milton Friedman, who spent a number of years of his work in the very theoretical without involvement in the political.
I think he is rather an exception
by
not getting corrupted by it.
But he has now become more involved because he has many specific suggestions for political solutions, which are, and he would clearly admit to this, compromises of his own theory.
Well, personally, I think even he is, in one respect, an instance, he's invested so much in a particular scheme of monetary policy that he refuses to consider what I regard as the ultimate solution of the problem, the denationalization of money, privatization. That is so much beyond his scope of his aims that he rejects it outside. I think largely with a prohibition that's politically impractical anyhow. I believe he even sees the theoretical attraction, but he doesn't think it's worth pursuing because it's not practical politics.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, and this is something I don't have a clear feel for, but I have a sense that then the yeoman farmer, as well as the theoretical intellectual, who both stay out of politics and do their own work, are much more closely aligned in that sense than is the intellectual who is working theoretically and the one who essentially sells himself to the political process.
Well, of course, there's a limit. I mean, see, I'm very interested in politics. In fact, in a way, I take part. I'm now very much engaged in strengthening Mrs. Thatcher's back in her fight against the unions. But I would refuse to take any sort of political opinion or political responsibility. I write articles. I've even achieved recently the dignity of an article's leader page of the London Times on that particular subject. I'm represented in England as an inspirer of Mrs. Thatcher, whom I've only met twice in my life on social occasions. And I enjoy this, but on the principle, I will not ask on any circumstances what is politically possible now. I concentrate on what I think is right and should be done if you can convince the public. If you can't, well, so much the worse, but that's not my affair.
It seems to me there's another related problem this suggests. You work, obviously, within a scholarly framework, etc. The average person is not in a position to be able to deal with the subtleties of your efforts because they don't have the basic education that permits them to do that. How does the translation between your work and thoughts and the need for the average person to have some sensitivity regarding them, how does that occur?
Well, I think under normal circumstances it ought not to be too difficult. Because what I call the intellectuals, in the sense in which I defined it before, the second-hand dealers of ideas, have to play a very important role and are very effective. But of course, in my particular span of life, I had the misfortune that the intellectuals were completely conquered by socialism. So I had no intermediaries, or hardly any, because they were prejudiced against my ideas by dominating philosophy. And that made it increasingly my concern to persuade the intellectuals in the hopes that ultimately they could be converted and transmit the idea to the public at large. That I cannot teach the public, I'm fully aware. I need these intermediaries. But their support has been denied to me for the greater part of my life. I did not teach an idea which, like those of Keynes, had an immediate appeal, which the immediate relevance, the practical problems, could be easily recognized. How much I was worried about these problems long ago, you will see when you look into an article I wrote, fully 25 years ago, called Socialism and the Intellectuals, which was actually published in the Chicago Law Review, but is reprinted in my volume of Studies in Philosophy and in Economics. There I've tried to explain both the general role of the intellectuals as the reason why the intellectuals of the last, of this century, I must say, it's about since the beginning of this century, we are so attracted by the socialist philosophy that they really became the main spreaders of socialism. Socialism has never been an affair of the proletarians. It has always been an affair of the intellectuals who have provided the working parties with the workers' parties with the philosophy. And there, well, that I believe I used the phrase here before today. That's why I believe that if the politicians do not destroy the world in the next 20 years, there's good hope. Because amongst the young people, there is a very definite reversion, an openness, which the most encouraging thing I've had in recent years, that even in the country where intellectually the situation seemed to be most hopeless, largely because it was completely dominated by the Cartesian rationalism in France, there's now the same reversion which has been taking place in England, America, and Germany for some years. That's for the first time, even in France, a group of nouveau economists who are opposing the nouveau philosophes and who are thinking on essentially the same lines on which I am thinking. That was the most encouraging experience I've had in recent times.
Changing to a somewhat different approach, what kinds of people, how would you describe an individual whom you have the greatest difficulty dealing with in terms of personality or attitude? Or
may I give a personal example?
Oh, please do.
I don't think there could ever be any communication between Mr. Galbraith and myself. I don't know why, but it's a way of thinking which I think is wholly irresponsible, which he thinks is the supreme of the height of intellectual effort, which I think is extremely shallow. I go so far as that when in this recent plan, which had to be postponed, of challenging an opposite group of socialist intellectuals, he was one of three whom I would exclude. I won't use the exact phrase, which would be libelous, which I don't want to be recorded, but he and two others I on principle excused because they thought in a way with which I could not communicate.
Can you give us a better sense of what the characteristics of this is?
I don't want to be offensive, but it's a certain attribute which is common to journalists to judge opinions by their likely appeal to the public.
In other words, you would say, you in this instance would feel that Galbraith is more of a journalistic type.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Do you find journalists generally to be would superficial be
It's always dangerous to generalize because there are some exceedingly good men among them and it does not apply. But in terms of numbers, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the basic corrupting element is, as you said, the desire to appear, to try to second guess what's going to be accepted or not accepted.
And the necessity to pretend to be competent on every subject which they really do not understand. They are under that necessity. I regret them. I'm sorry for them. But to pretend to understand all the things you write about and habitually to write about things you do not understand is a very corrupting thing.
You cover a broad range of interests and intellectual areas. What are some that you're totally incompetent in? Or put it another way. Let me make it more specific because that's too general. What area do you receive questions about on a more most frequent basis that you feel is categorically beyond your professional area of competence?
Well, apart from certain parts of the arts where my interests are very limited, religion. I just lack the ear for it. I mean, quite frankly, at a very early stage when I tried people to explain to me what they mean by the word God, and nobody could, I lost access to the whole field. I still don't know what people mean by God, and while I'm in a curious conflict because I'm very strong positive feelings on the need of an ununderstood moral tradition, but all the factual assertions of religion, which is crudely all belief in ghosts of any kind, has become completely unintelligible to me. I can no longer even sympathize with it, still less explain it.
That's fascinating because one of the things that has occurred to me, it's an irritant, it's a frustration because of my own personal desires to communicate certain precepts, is that the sense that motivates the quote religious person is something that is very powerful. And in a way, if one could find a way to use that motivation as a basis of support and understanding for, say, the precepts of a liberal, free society, it could be extremely effective.
You know, in spite of these strong views I have, I've never publicly argued against religion. Because I agree that probably most people need it. It's probably the only way in which certain things, certain traditions can be maintained which are essential. But I won't claim any particular deep insight in this. You see, I was brought up essentially in an irreligious family. My grandfather was a zoologist in the main Darwinian era. Of course, know what the effect is. My father, my maternal grandfather, had no religious beliefs. In fact, when I was a boy of, I suppose, 8 or 9, I was presented with a children's Bible, and when I got too fascinated by it, it somehow disappeared. So, I have little religious background. Although I might add to it that having grown up in a Roman Catholic family, I've never formally left the creed, In theory, I'm a Roman Catholic. If I fill out the form, I say Roman Catholic, merely because this is the tradition in which I've grown up. I don't believe a word of it.
It's interesting. Yeah. Do you get questions about religion? I would assume a lot of people confuse your interest in a moral structure with religion.
Very rarely, it so happens that an Indian girl who is trying to write a biography of me finally and very hesitantly came up with the question which the girl put to Faust: how do you hold it with religion? But that was rather an exceptional case. In general, people do not ask. I suppose you understand, although I never practically never talk about it. I hate offending people on things which is very dear to them and which doesn't then do any harm.
Doesn't your thinking in terms of a moral structure, the concept of just conduct, doesn't it at least get at some very fundamental part of religious precepts?
Yes, I think it goes to the question which people try to answer by religion, that there are, in the surrounding world, a great many orderly phenomena which we cannot understand, which we have to accept. And in a way, I've recently discovered that the polytheistic religions of Buddhism appeal rather more to me than the monotheistic religions of the West. If they confine themselves, as some Buddhists do, in a profound respect for the existence of other orderly structures in the world, which they admit they cannot fully understand or interpret, I think that's an admirable attitude. And so far as I do feel hostile to religion, it's against the monotheistic religions because they are so frightfully intolerant. All monotheistic religions are intolerant and try to enforce their particular creed. Well, I've just been looking a little into the Japanese position where you don't even have to belong to one religion. Almost every Japanese is Shintoist in one respect and Buddhist in the other, and this is recognized as reconcilable. Every Japanese is born, married, and buried as a Shintoist, but all his beliefs are Buddhist. I think that's an admirable state of affairs.
And it's one of those activities which we discussed earlier that it's not a calamitous thing. One's personal decisions don't affect substantially the society around. We're about finished with this one. We're going to change tapes very shortly. Getting back to the question I asked you about people you dislike or can't deal with. Can you make any additional comments in that regard? In terms of the characteristics of people that trouble you?
I don't have many strong dislikes. I admit that as a teacher, I have no racial prejudices in general. But there are certain types. Conspicuous among the Near Eastern population, which I still dislike because they are fundamentally dishonest. And I must say dishonesty is a thing I intensely dislike. It was a type which in my childhood in Austria was described as Levantine, typical of the people of the Eastern Mediterranean. But I encountered it later, and I have a profound dislike to the typical Indian students at the London School of Economics, which I admit were all one type, Bengali moneylender's sons. And they are to me a detestable type, I admit. But not in any racial feeling, it's a, I found little of the same amongst the Egyptians, a basic lack of honesty in them. And if I try speaking about honesty, I think honesty is really the best expression of what I call the morals of a civilized society. Primitive man lacks a conception of honesty. And even medieval man would put honor higher than honesty. And honor and honesty have turned out to be very different conceptions. And I became very much aware of it, contrasting the, quite deliberately began to be interested in this subject, the different moral outlook of an officer and a broker in the stock exchange. In my traditional environment, the officer was regarded as a better kind of person. I've come to the conviction that a broker in the stock exchange is a much more honest person than an average officer. In fact, with the officer, as I knew them, the Austro-Hungarian army, making debts which he could not pay was not a shameful thing to do. It did not conflict with his honor, but of course it was dishonest. While I sometimes like to shock people by saying that probably the most honest group of men are the members of the stock exchange. Because they keep all their promises.
Yes, they do. In that sense, one could say that the bookie on the streets of Manhattan...
I suppose so. I have no experience with them.
I don't either. But I understand that at least within the enforcement potential that exists there, that a bookie always pays his bets.
Yes, yes.
Can be totally trusted in
It's completely comparable to the stock exchange people.
And honor, you're suggesting, then, involves precepts that are not statistically or susceptible to statistical analysis. Honor is a more...
The robber baron was a very honored and honorful people, but he was certainly not an honest person in the ordinary sense. I mean, the whole traditional concepts of aristocracy, of which I have a certain conception, I mean, I have moved to some extent in aristocratic circles, and I like their style of life. But I knew that in the strict commercial sense, they're not necessarily honest. They, like the officers, will make debts they know they cannot pay.
Mm-hmm. How about intellectual dishonesty?
Well, of course, that's the thing I particularly dislike. And if it were more easy to draw the line, strictly speaking, of course, every moral prejudice which enters into your intellectual argument is a dishonesty. But none of us can wholly avoid it. And where to draw the line, where you blame a person for letting non-intellectual arguments enter into his intellectual conclusions is a very difficult thing to decide. Everyone has to pardon a great deal in this field. It's humanly unavoidable.
Very difficult also because the individual...
Come back to the journalists. In their environment, under the conditions in which they work, they probably can't be blamed for what they do. And still more about the politicians. I mean, it's one part of my present argument that we have created institutions in which the politicians are forced to be partial, to be corrupt in the strict sense. I mean, their business is to satisfy a particular interest to keep in power. I mean, it's impossible in that situation to be strictly honest. But it's not their fault, it's the fault of the institutions which we have created.